So, okay, so in this talk, I will first give a brief introduction to cryptography and lattices, the issue of relating average case and worst case complexity of computational problems, especially in the context of cryptography, and then move to the core of the talk, which concerns a special class of lattices, namely sig lattices and some generalization called ideal lattices. I will introduce in the talk. And the problems I'm going to talk about could turn out to be related to certain problems in algebraic number theory, an area I don't really know much about, but at least there seems to be some interesting connections, so I wanted to mention them to you, followed by a long list of open problems. So you already heard about lattices yesterday in Fong's talk, so I will be brief. But if you have any question, you can interrupt me any time, and I would be happy to give more explanations and details. So a lattice is the set of intersection points of a grid. And all the pictures in the talk will be two-dimensional, but you can think of n-dimensional lattices. And that's the interesting object from a computational point of view. As you move in higher dimension, many problems become quite hard. Lattices are typically represented by a basis, a set of vectors in a Euclidean space, and algebraically the lattice points are the integer linear combinations of the basis vectors. So you are given such a set of points, and there are various parameters of interest that can be defined. One is the length of the shortest vector in the lattice, the minimum distance between any two lattice points. And this quantity can be generalized to something called the successive minima of the lattice. Think of starting from the origin and drawing a very small sphere around the origin. Initially, it only contains zero. As the sphere gets larger, it will contain one linearly independent point, one non-zero lattice vector. And it will contain 3 points, but they are all in a line, so the other 2 points don't really count. And this sphere is has radius lambda 1. And if you get larger spheres, you will get more linearly independent points. In two dimension, you will stop once you get points that span a two-dimensional vector space. And that's the parameter lambda 2, the largest successive minimum of the lattice. These are mathematical definitions, but you can define some natural computational problems associated to these parameters. Namely, given a lattice, you can represent it by a basis, you can consider the computational problem of finding a short vector in the lattice, a lattice vector v of length at most lambda 1 in the exact version, or for approximate versions of the problem, you can ask for a lattice vector of length slightly bigger than lambda 1, lambda 1 times some approximation factor gamma. Same thing for lambda n. In the case of lambda n, you will ask for not one, but n linearly independent lattice vectors, such that the length of all of them, the maximum length of this set, is small compared to lambda n, not much bigger than lambda n. Now, the approximation factor gamma is typically a function of the dimension n of the lattice, because as you move to lattices in higher and higher dimensions, the problems become harder from a computational point of view. So how hard? Well, they seem quite hard. You heard about all those efforts in getting good lattice approximation algorithms yesterday. The brief summary is the following. If you consider approximation factors that grow only polynomially in the dimension of the lattice n, then no approximation algorithm that runs in polynomial time is known. There is no known efficient algorithm. And in order to achieve polynomial running time, you need to consider factors that are much larger than that. They are essentially exponential in the dimension n of the lattice. So is this evidence that the problem is hard? Yes, probably it is good evidence because people tried very hard to find better algorithms. At the same time, people were also able to prove anti-hardness results, giving more evidence of the hardness of these problems, but only for very small factors that are constant, that don't grow with the dimension. Still, we can show that for any constant approximation factor, the problem is NP-hard. So based on this evidence, NP-hardness result and lack of good approximation algorithms, it is easy to conjecture that the shortest vector problem, lambda 1, and the shortest independent vector problem associated to lambda n are hard problems to approximate when the approximation factor grows polynomially rather than exponentially in the dimension of the lattice. And this assumption, the assumed hardness of approximating lattice problems within polynomial factors, has been used as the basis for the construction of cryptographic functions. But are these lattice problems really hard in practice? Well, there are many constructions that can be broken, if not in theory, at least in practice, running powerful lattice reduction algorithms. And LLL and variants of lattice reduction have been used to break many lattice-based cryptographic functions, and they also seem to perform much better in practice than the theoretical worst-case exponential approximation factor. So maybe in practice, polynomial factor, we have to be careful when dealing with polynomial approximation factors. Also, if you consider polynomial approximation factors that are not very large, factors of the form square root of n, factors that are large enough, so not n to the epsilon, but say square root of n or n, then it is possible to give interactive proof systems for these lattice problems. Now, what an interactive proof system is doesn't matter. The bottom line is that the problem is unlikely to be NP-hard when the approximation factor is square root of n or larger. So it's clear that the problems are getting easier and easier as the approximation factor grows. And on the average, the problems might be much easier than what we may expect based on worst case performance of algorithms. So it is reasonable to conjecture that lattice problems are hard to approximate within polynomial factors, provided that we make two important remarks. One is that we are considering the worst case complexity of these problems. It is reasonable to say that no algorithm can find good approximations for every single lattice. It is not as reasonable to assume that no algorithm will find good approximations for most lattices, because when the lattice is chosen at random, the algorithm might perform much better. Also, the factor, it's okay to consider polynomial factors because we don't even know how to get strong sub-exponential factors. But even with this polynomial factor, we don't want it to be, say, n to the 100. We want to play with factors that are closer to being linear or small degree polynomials. So lattice-based cryptography uses the hardness of lattice problems as a source of computational hardness to secure cryptographic functions. And there are various classes of results and proposals. They basically fall into two categories, public key encryption schemes and one-way collision-resistant hash functions. A common feature of these primitives is that they are provably secure. Probably secure based on the worst case intractability of lattice problems. So they assume that lattices are hard in the worst case. So let me spend a few words it's always worth to emphasize this issue of average case versus worst case complexity assumption. If you think of the typical number theoretic cryptographic function that is, say, probably secure, take modular squaring. There is a number n which is the product of two primes, and let's consider a function that, given a number x, squares the number and reduces it modulo n. Now, this function, which is Rabin's encryption function, is well known to be equivalent to factoring, in the sense that provided P and Q are congruent to 1 modulo 4 and so on, if you can invert the function, then you can also factor the modulus n. There is a reduction, a proof of security, showing that inverting the function is as hard as factoring. However, this proof of security is a one-to-one kind of proof. Every modulus n is mapped to one specific instance of the cryptographic function to be broken. And breaking this specific function, fn, for one specific value of n, will allow you to factor just that modulus, just that number. Now, in practice, in cryptography, you want functions that are hard to break with very high probability. The key, the function from the family, will be chosen at random. So in order to be confident that you are on the safe side, you want most functions to be hard to invert. In order to argue mathematically that the function is hard to invert, you need to assume that a corresponding large fraction of the moduli are hard to factor. So if you assume that most integers, n, that are product of two primes, are hard to factor, then most functions of this form are hard to invert. So here in this discussion, I will typically use the color blue for the cryptographic functions and the color green for underlying mathematical problems. And here there is not much difference between the problem and the function. But as we move to lattices, they will be quite different objects. So colors can help a bit to keep track of what is what. So this is the standard average case proof of security that assumes that a certain mathematical problem is hard on the average and builds a cryptographic function out of it. The kind of proof of security used when dealing with lattices is a much more powerful kind of proof where the reduction is randomized and every single mathematical problem, L, is mapped not to one specific instance of the function, but to a randomly selected function from the class of functions to be inverted or broken. And the distribution of functions is almost random and independent from which point you start from. So it doesn't matter which lattice point you take, you apply the reduction and you will get a random function in this class. Now, what is the implication of having such a randomized reduction? The implication is that even if the underlying problem is hard, but only in a very mild sense, it is hard in the worst case. There is one specific lattice for which we don't know how to solve the problem. Then it follows that most functions, most cryptographic functions, based on this reduction and construction, are hard to break. Why? Consider a set of functions that can be broken. We want to argue that this set of functions is very small. The fraction of functions for which you can perform the inversion task efficiently must be negligible. The reason is that, well, we assume that this problem is a hard in the worst case. So most instances might be easy, but there must be at least one instance which is hard. You can apply the reduction and get a random instance of the function. Now, typically, this function will be hard to invert. So you will not be able to invert it. You will not be able to solve the underlying lattice problem. But if this happens, you can run the reduction again, starting from the same lattice, and map it again to another independently chosen function. Again, it will be hard to invert. But if the fraction of functions that can be inverted is non-negligible, by performing this reduction over and over, sooner or later you're bound to hit this wide set of functions that can be easily inverted, and this will allow you to solve that specific single instance of the lattice problem, which was assumed to be the hardest one. So assuming there exists a single lattice, well, talking about a single lattice doesn't really make any sense because complexity is studied in an asymptotic setting, but we can in a certain sense talk about single lattices. So if that specific lattice, if there exists even a single lattice for which the best algorithm doesn't work, then most functions must be hard to invert, must be cryptographically secure. Now, this is the kind of hardness and cryptographic security proved for lattice-based hash functions. And, one important thing to notice is that for this kind of reductions, when going from the mathematical problem to the cryptographic function, we want in some sense to forget which mathematical problem we started from. All lattices should give rise to the same distribution on functions. So typically, the underlying problems and the functions will look quite different. There is not the function here on the right will not necessarily be a clearly lattice-related function. So on the green world, on the mathematical world, I'll be using lattices. Let me tell you what kind of functions I'll be using on the other side. So I'll consider cryptographic functions that are instances of the subset sum problem. Now, subset sum is the classic problem where you are given a set of weights, which are typically integers. I give you some target value b, and you want to find a subset of the weights that adds up to b. And there is a corresponding function. The function uses the weights as a key. It takes as input a subset, which is typically represented as a binary vector that tells you which weights you are selecting. So when you compute the function, you take as input a subset and you output the sum, the total weight of the subset. And inverting the function is solving the subset sum problem. Given the weights, the description of the function, and the output of the function, the problem is to find a subset that produces the right value. And subset sum has been around in cryptography for a very long time. There have been proposals of using subset sum in cryptography since the early days of modern cryptography, but most proposals were broken. So there's been some new result in the mid-late 90s that revived interest in using knapsack and subset sum as a problem for cryptography. It's a result that we did at ITIE that showed that subset sum functions over vectors with small coefficients in n dimensions is hard to invert on the average, provided certain lattice problems, for example, the shortest independent vector problem, are hard to approximate within certain polynomial factors. And the polynomial factors initially were fairly large polynomials, n to the 8 or bigger, and the factor has been reduced to smaller and smaller ones, till the currently best known result shows the hardness of those functions based on the worst case assumption that is not possible to efficiently approximate the shortest vector within factors that are of the form n by n, so essentially linear in the dimension of the lattice. Unfortunately, these functions with this very strong theoretical security guarantee based on worst-case assumptions, were still broken in practice. They were still subject to attacks. But it is important to realize the difference between attacks to the recent cryptographic functions that have been proved secure based on lattices and the early work breaking subset sum-like functions, where those functions had no support in proof of security. So the attacks to subset sum and similar functions can be divided into categories. Some are specific to the way you embed a secret decryption trapdoor into the knapsack in order to achieve decryption. And these attacks are usually very powerful. They are asymptotic attack. They show some design flaw in the cryptographic function. And even if you increase the size of the key, the complexity of the attack grows polynomially. So those functions are completely broken. There are other attacks which are generic. They can be applied to any subset sum instance. And we know that subset sum is NP-hard. So these attacks cannot possibly solve every single instance of knapsack, but they happen to be very effective in practice. Can be applied to arbitrary subset sum-based systems. They work only heuristically, but they work. And they can be typically avoided if you increase the size of the security parameter. The complexity of the attack is exponential in the security parameter. So you can avoid them. But in order to avoid them, you have to use keys that are very, very big. So the attacks, even asymptotically, they don't say much. They can be really devastating in practice. But this is mostly an efficiency issue. So let's try to understand the efficiency issue. When you take subset sum, you are typically given n numbers where every number is n bits long. And this, in some technical sense, is the hardest possible case when the density of the knapsack is 1. And the size of this function is n squared. You have n numbers. Every number is n bits long, so you still you have, in order to achieve security, n. Notice the function can be broken in time 2 to the n by exhaustive search, by trying all 0, 1 input combinations. And but the size of the key, instead of being linear in n, is quadratic in n. So you want to set n to a few hundreds to avoid heuristic attacks, and you can easily end up with keys that are megabytes in size, that are fairly large and are not quite efficient from a practical point of view. So there is, once we realize that the main issue here is efficiency, we can think of ways to improve the efficiency and key size representation. For example, you can consider the so-called compact knapsacks, where instead of taking 0, 1 combinations of the weights, you take combinations of the weights with larger multipliers. So instead we take a set of weights, A1 to AM, and instead of combining them with the 0, 1 multipliers, we combine them with multipliers that are, say, n bits long. And the exhaustive, so if you consider the trivial attack, exhaustive search, then even if you take a very small number of weights, say a constant, since there are exponentially many possibilities to be tried for every input coefficient, the search space is again exponential. So the trivial attack does not work, but at the same time, we obtain a function with a much smaller representation. We have only a constant number of weights. Every weight will be order of n bits, so the total function size will be linear in the security parameter n rather than being quadratic. So is this a good idea? Did we solve all the problems of efficiency in getting practical functions out of SAP? No, this is a terrible idea. These functions were broken in even a stronger sense than general subset sum once. And the intuition is that once you reduce the number of weights to a constant, this is essentially an integer programming problem with a finite number of variables, which, using lattices, can be solved in polynomial time. So these functions were broken both in theory and in practice, and people pretty much gave up using knapsack for cryptography till the theoretical interest that followed Itai's discovery. Still, the Itai's discovery does not solve the practical problems of getting efficient functions. And this is the topic of this talk. Is it possible to save the idea of using knapsacks, and especially compact knapsacks, so that we can achieve efficiency and at the same time achieve security? And the idea is to use a ring different from the integers. Instead of adding up integers, like in the subset sum problem, we'll consider a generalization of the knapsack or subset sum problem over arbitrary rings. And so this is on the cryptographic side, the blue world. We are designing a cryptographic function, and the function will operate on polynomials. We are going to use a ring of polynomials, take polynomials with integer coefficients in a variable x, and then in order to work with a finite set, with a finite ring, we can reduce the coefficients of the polynomial modulo a small integer, p, say 5, and we can also reduce the degree of the polynomials. We can work modulo, for example, x to the n minus 1, so that we never need to use polynomials of degree higher than n. So the operations in the ring are defined in the usual way. We have polynomial addition and polynomial multiplication, but when we perform multiplication, we reduce everything modulo x to the n minus 1, and we also reduce the coefficients of the polynomial modulo p. In terms of vectors, if we look at the coefficients of the polynomial as a vector, the addition operation is the vector sum modulo p, while the product operation is the convolution of the two vectors. So the proposal is to use a ring of modular polynomials to define our knapsack function. And well, it turns out that it's very important to choose this polynomial Q the right way. I'll say more about it, but for now let's consider x to the n minus 1. And as an input, we can consider polynomials with small coefficients. In general, a coefficient can be any number reduced modulo p. We'll consider polynomials with coefficients that are much smaller than p. Say p to the d, where d is smaller than 1. And so it turns out that once you change the ring this way, then instead of being breakable in polynomial time, this function becomes much harder to break and still efficient to compute. And this on the cryptographic side. What about proof of security? It is possible to build a proof of security which depends on the conjectured hardness of lattice problems. But we need to conjecture that lattice problems are hard for a special class of lattices. Namely, we consider lattices with a cyclic structure. The definition of cyclicity is the natural one, is the same one used in coding theory. We define a rotation operation that, given a vector, rotates the coordinates and bring the last coordinate in the first place. And we say that a lattice is cyclic if it is closed under this rotation operation. So it's the exact analogous of the definition of cyclic codes, which are the probably most useful and widely studied class of error-correcting codes. So our computational problems, like SVP, shortest vector problem, can be restricted to cyclic lattices in the natural way. Given a cyclic lattice, find the shortest vector in the lattice. Notice that given a lattice, it's very easy to determine whether the lattice is cyclic or not. You rotate the lattice and then check if the result is equivalent to the original lattice. So checking given two bases if they generate the same lattice is a problem that can be easily solved using linear algebra. So in this talk, there won't be enough time to go through the actual proof of security, so I will concentrate on describing connections between these and other problems, but you can find all proofs and details in papers that are all published or available on my webpage. There is a long version of my first paper that is about to appear in computational complexity. You can already find this one on my webpage, and this is probably a good introductory reading. But I've been, my original paper only proved that the function I proposed is one way. In practice, it is nice to have collision-resistant hash functions, and I couldn't prove that. And the reason is that the function is not collision-resistant, but this last year, Pagert and Rosen and Lubashensky and myself independently found two different but similar ways to modify the function and prove that it is collision resistant once you fix it. And then we also did some work together into implementation issues. And it turns out that there is a very nice way to implement the function using FFT for the polynomial multiplication that gives functions that are potentially very fast to compute. So it seems that we are on track toward getting functions that are efficient enough to be practical. So let's go back to the security issue. Now, using x to the n minus 1, I told you before, is not a good idea. That's what I was using when proving one-wayness. It turns out that you can find collisions if you use x to the n minus 1. So we consider a generalization of cyclic lattices, where we take, we look at the lattice as a set of polynomials. And instead of reducing them modulo x to the n minus 1, we reduce them modulo an arbitrary polynomial. Now, in the case of x to the n minus 1, it is easy to see that using this modulus is exactly the same as considering cyclic lattices. Namely, so this is a ring. Cyclic lattices are exactly the ideals in this ring when q is x to the n minus 1, because ideals are subsets of the ring closed by multiplication by the variable x. So if you take a polynomial, multiply it by x, and then reduce it, modulo x to the n minus 1, you get exactly the same as taking the polynomial, mapping it, and then rotating, mapping it to get a vector, and then instead of multiplying by a variable, perform a rotation on the coordinates. So we consider a generalization where Q is an arbitrary monic polynomial. We consider of degree n. We consider polynomials modulo Q, and we can look at these sets of polynomials as lattices. And ideal lattices are exactly those set of vectors or set of polynomials, depending on the representation, that are ideals in this ring. So these are the problems, and if you use, for example, x to the n plus 1 and n is a power of 2, then you get a collision-resistant hash function. Now, in the rest, you can use other values for q, but in the rest of the talk, I will focus on this specific polynomial, x to the n plus 1. For the following two reasons, which are important in the proof. One is that when you take a polynomial or vector multiplied by x to the n and then reduce it modulo q, all you are doing is to rotate the coordinates but changing the sign of the entry that wraps around. And this operation does not change the length of the vector. If you look at the coefficients as a vector, this operation preserves the length, and that's good for the proof of security. The other important property is that this polynomial Q must be irreducible. And collisions in the hash function that uses x to the n minus 1 can be found exactly by exploiting the fact that x to the n minus 1 is a linear factor. So, once you choose the right parameters, you can get a proof of security where the hash function is collision resistant, assuming that the shortest vector problem is hard to approximate within almost linear factors, a factor of the form n poly log n, but when restricted to lattices, which are ideal with respect to this modular polynomial. The proof is a nice mixture of algebraic and geometric ideas. And I will not cover the proof, but just let me tell you a few words that illustrate the algebraic features of the proof. So the worst case problem is given an ideal, ideal lattice represented as an ideal in the ring of polynomials modulo fx, you want to find a short vector in this ideal lattice. And the proof works going through an iteration process. It starts from an arbitrary, possibly long vector, which is much longer than lambda 1. And at every step, you will find a slightly shorter vector. And by iterating the proof over and over, you will find shorter and shorter vectors until you get a vector which is of length almost lambda 1. Now, we don't know how to find shorter and shorter vectors. In order to perform this step, we use an oracle that breaks the cryptographic function, and in this sense, we prove the security of the cryptographic function. We are showing that if you can break the cryptographic function on the average, then you can use this attack as a black box within this iteration, and in the end, solve the underlying shortest vector problem for lattices that have a special structure. Now, the geometric techniques are mostly borrowed from previous work based on general lattices. So I will not illustrate that. I will illustrate something that is different between general lattices and the ideal lattices considered in this talk, to show you how using structural lattices can sometimes make things easier. Now, in general lattices, we define two problems, the shortest vector problem and the shortest independent vector problem. In one case, you want to find one vector, which is the shortest possible. In the other case, you want to find not one, but n linearly independent vectors that are simultaneously short. Now, if we work modulo x to the n plus 1 in this the corresponding class of lattices, these two problems become essentially equivalent. The reason is that given a single vector represented by a polynomial, you can consider all the other polynomials obtained by multiplying this g by x, or some power of x. X is the indeterminate in our polynomial ring. And we know that multiplying by x does not change the Euclidean length of the vector. We are shifting, rotating, moving, changing the sign, the length is still the same. And since the factor x to the n plus 1 is irreducible, these polynomials must be linearly independent. So if I give you one vector of length at most 10, then for free you also get n linearly independent vectors of the same length. So in particular, lambda 1 and lambda n for lattices with this structure are always the same. So geometrically, if you take a sphere around the origin, initially there is only the origin. And as soon as you get one non-zero point, you also get n linearly independent points. So far, so good. Lattices with cyclic or ideal structure can be used to get good functions. So why don't we use that already? Well, there is still a lot of work to be done. In particular, an area that requires still a lot of investigation is the complexity of cyclic lattices, or ideal lattices more generally. And practically nothing is known. In the case of coding theory, there's been extensive work on the theory of cyclic correcting codes. Lattices have also been used in coding theory, but it appears that the coding theorists have not been used cyclicity or similar structures so far in that setting. So essentially we don't know anything. It is interesting to ask whether lattice problems are NP-hard to approximate within constant factors or even the exact version, also when the lattice has this kind of structure. However, we can be fairly confident that the problem doesn't become that easy immediately. The reason is that if we take the best known algorithms to approximate lattice problems, they don't seem to perform any better on cyclic lattices than the general case. The reason is that the best lattice reduction algorithms are geometric, while cyclicity is an algebraic structure. So it seems that LLL and lattice reduction is unable to see the algebraic structure and take advantage of it. So it is reasonable at this point, based on our current knowledge, to conjecture that lattice problems are harder to approximate within small polynomial factors, and at least in the worst case, even when the lattice is cyclic. So let's move to algebraic number theory in this last part of the talk. I will only give the definitions, just to explain what the problem is, and hoping that maybe somebody more knowledgeable in algebraic number theory might see something that I don't in there. So let's take the field of rational numbers Q. We can take, is this a subset of complex numbers? So we can take one more complex number. So a number C is called algebraic if there exists a polynomial with rational coefficients that achieves the value zero at that point. So algebraic numbers are the zeros of polynomials with rational coefficients. And for every complex number that is algebraic, we can define the minimal polynomial as the lowest degree polynomial that achieves the value zero when computed on that number. And it turns out that this minimal polynomial is unique. Any other polynomial achieves the value zero even only if it is a multiple of the minimal polynomial. And we call two complex numbers conjugates if they have the same minimal polynomial. And this I will define the equivalence relation on complex numbers. Now, this basic undergrounding, I apologize in advance with the mathematicians in the audience about reviewing things that are as basic as this, but for computer scientists, it's a way to look up the definition in a book to make sure we don't say anything silly. So, okay, so we can consider extension fields. We take the field of rational numbers, we can extend it by adjoining, by adding one more complex number to it. For example, we take the we can take the rational numbers and include also square root of 2. And immediately we get all the numbers of the form a plus square root of 2b, where a and b are rationals. And same thing can be done by using the square root of minus 1, that will give you the Gauss integers, and so on. And there is a nice isomorphism between extension fields, extensions of the rationals plus some algebraic numbers, and quotient fields, where you take polynomials with rational coefficients modulo the minimal polynomial of the complex number. Because of this isomorphism, if you take two complex numbers that are conjugates, if you consider the corresponding extension fields, the extension fields are also isomorphic one to the other, and the isomorphism is the function that sends one algebraic number C1 to the other one C2. And this is the last slide with the basic definition that should already illustrate how algebraic numbers relate to lattices. So we consider a subset of algebraic numbers. Algebraic numbers are the zeros of polynomials with rational coefficients. We consider zeros of monic polynomials with integer coefficients. And these are called algebraic integers. And the same way you extend a field, the field of the rationals, by adjoining a complex number, you can also extend the ring of integers by adjoining a complex number. And considering these extension rings gives structures that are very similar to lattices. And the intuition is that if you have an algebraic number C, C is the zero of a polynomial of degree n, consider all the numbers that can be expressed using C. You can perform addition and multiplication. With multiplication, you can get all the powers of C, but once you get C to the n, since C is the zero of a polynomial of degree n, this number turns out to be equal to a linear integer combination of the previous numbers. So these complex numbers give you a sort of, even if you are working in two dimension, they give you a sort of n-dimensional basis, abstract basis for a lattice-like structure. Yeah?
What do you mean by the third bullet point?
This one?
Yeah.
If you take an algebraic integer of degree n, so it's the zero of a polynomial of degree n, extending the integers with C gives you something that is isomorphic as an additive group to Zn. So every element in this ring can be written as an integer linear combination of these n complex numbers. You can look at the multipliers of these n complex numbers as the coordinates of a vector in Zn.
And n is the degree of the...
N is the degree of the algebraic number. It's the degree of the monic polynomial that achieves the value zero in C. So all of this...
The notation is wrong.
So I use the field extension of it. So square brackets for ring. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get all of these definitions are just to introduce a problem, which I don't know if it's a standard problem in algebraic number theory, but is not too esoteric to present it as a possibly interesting problem. The problem is the following. So let's fix an algebraic integer C, and let's consider the corresponding extension ring with the Z square brackets adjoint C. Now, the input is an ideal of this ring, and the goal is given an ideal in this ring of integers, find an element in the ideal such that all of its conjugates are small, where small, I mean, small in absolute value as complex numbers.
Capital I is the same as capital S here.
Capital.
The ideal is S,
and then the ideal is I. And I guess it's
So find an element V in the ideal S such that every conjugate to V is small, is as small as possible. And so how do you specify algebraic numbers and so on? It's fairly easy. I mean, it doesn't matter which algebraic number you use, they all give essentially the same ring. And you can specify it, for example, by giving the minimal polynomial and which root you use ends up giving the same result. So this is the problem. Given an ideal of the integers of a number field, find an element such that all of its conjugates are small. How do you specify what?
The ideal?
The ideal can be specified given a set of generators. So I give you a set of generators the hard part is possibly to specify the algebraic. So the algebraic number is specified by giving the minimal polynomial, and the ideal is specified by a set of generators. I think that the hardness of the problem is pretty much independent from the specific representation. Any other reasonable representation is polynomial equivalent. So what can we say about this new problem, the smallest conjugate problem? It's closely related to finding short vectors in the corresponding class of lattices. Let's fix this specific polynomial, x to the n plus 1. Let's say that S is an ideal sublattice in this ring. And the shortest vector problem in this ideal lattice is find a polynomial G in S such that the norm of G is small. Consider the corresponding problem of interpret all these vectors as polynomials and evaluate these polynomials on omega to n, which is the 2nth root of unity. And so we map this set of vectors to a set of polynomials and then complex numbers. So we evaluate the numbers on this root, and we obtain as a result a set of complex numbers, which turns out to be an ideal, because the lattice is closed under the ideal operation. And now the problem is find a complex number in this ideal such that all of the conjugates to this number are small. And it is relatively easy, it's fairly easy to show that these two problems, finding short vectors in this ideal lattice and finding elements with small conjugates in this ideal of the integer rings, are related by the relation that the element with the maximum conjugates achieves a value which up to square root of n factors is equal to the best solution to the shortest vector problem. So these relations allows to give reductions from the shortest vector problem on ideal lattices to the small conjugate problem, and also in the opposite direction. The reduction is standard. Let's say that you are given an ideal lattice, S in green. We know that there is a small vector, a small polynomial in this ideal. We want to find it, or we want to find something that is not much bigger than F. Now, just knowing about the existence of such a polynomial with small coefficients allows to argue that if we evaluate all the polynomials in the lattice on this omega of 2n, we get an ideal of the ring of integers, and we know that one of the elements of this ideal in the ring has a maximum conjugate, which is at most the square root of n times the norm of F, which was the short vectors in the original ideal lattice. So there exists a solution of this length, So using an oracle that solves the small conjugate problem, we can find some other element in the same ideal which has smallest conjugate, at most gamma times whatever bound we proved on the best solution to the problem. So this way we get an element in the ring with small conjugates, namely at most this much, and we can go from this complex number with small conjugates back to a vector, namely the coefficients of the vector g, and we know that the norm of this vector will be at most the square root of n, the maximum conjugate of the corresponding complex number, and well, this square root of n and square root of n get combined, and the result is a reduction from shortest vector problem in ideal lattices to the smallest conjugate problem that loses a factor n in the approximation. If you can approximate smallest conjugates within factor gamma, then you can approximate ideal shortest vector problem within a factor n gamma. And of course, the class of ideal lattices and the X ring over here should be the corresponding one. So the rings used here are those obtained by adjoining one of the roots of the minimal polynomial used in the definition of ideal lattices. So ideal lattices, I'm using this as a generic term, but for every polynomial, you get a class of ideal lattices. If you use x to the n minus 1, you get cyclic lattices. If you use some other polynomial, you get some other cyclic lattices. And for every such class, there is such a reduction. You can give essentially the same reduction also in the opposite direction. If you can solve shortest vector problem in ideal lattices within a factor gamma, then you can solve the small conjugate problem within a factor just slightly bigger by a linear factor, within a factor n gamma. So in this last 4 minutes, I will describe some open problems.
What is the complexity of the reductions?
Sorry?
The complexity of the reductions?
Very small, like linear. The reduction is basically the one on the slide. It's so probably linear or maybe quadratic, or it's almost a syntactic translation. And the interesting part, which is also fairly easy but requires writing down a few lines of proof, is to prove this bound between the smallest conjugate and vector norm of corresponding elements. So essentially, the proof of this theorem, which is purely a mathematical theorem, is the only work to be done.
But this reduction is deterministic? Or
yeah, this is a worst case to worst case reduction. So, good question. So, to summarize, we show that if you can break the cryptographic function on the average, then you can solve the shortest vector problem in ideal lattices in the worst case. So the reduction shows that if you can solve the shortest vector problem in ideal lattices in the worst case, you can solve the smallest conjugate problem in the worst case. By combining these two reductions together, we obtain that the cryptographic function is hard to break on the average, assuming the worst case hardness of solving the smallest conjugate problem. So yes, the reduction in this slide is a world standard, classic, simple, worst case to worst case reduction. And in fact, getting some average case reduction in the algebraic setting without going through lattices is an interesting open problem. So open problems, well, we know that SVP is NP-hard over general lattices. Is the same true when the lattice is cyclic or ideal? Even in the exact case, we don't know the answer to this question. Now, similar questions arise also in coding theory when working with finite fields. And also in that case, despite all the work on cyclic codes, there is no known NP hardness results for, say, the coding of general cyclic codes. There is a recent result by Guruswamy and Vardy for pointing somehow in this direction. They show that maximum likelihood the coding of Reed-Solomon codes is NP-hard, but they are short and they are puncturing the code, and by puncturing the code they destroy the cyclicity. So it doesn't imply hardness for cyclic codes. Another class of open problems regards the performance of LLL. So based on some preliminary investigation, experimental investigation, it seems that LLL doesn't see the algebraic structure and doesn't do any better on cyclic lattices. There is no reason to believe it will give better results. The question is, can we actually prove it? For LLL, we have simple examples showing that LLL, in the worst case, achieves exponential factor. There are bases which are LLL reduced, but they have all very long vectors. Can you come up with a cyclic example? Can you come up with a cyclic lattice which, with a basis which is LLL reduced, but it only contains vectors that are exponentially longer than the shortest vector in the lattice? On the positive side, finding some way to use algebraic properties within LLL is also an interesting thing to try out. Next, cyclic lattices, and they have a lot of structure, but still, well, as long as we work with worst case reductions, it's not ruled out that there might be a reduction that, given an oracle to solve the problems on cyclic lattices, you can use it as, and solve problems for arbitrary lattices. So there is a paper with a similar title, which solves a different problem by Patz and Schnorr, showing that general lattices are equivalent to lattices with cyclic factor group. So the word cyclic is in the title, but it's a different property. But this is an example that putting properties on the lattices does not necessarily make the problem easier, and it might be possible to give actual reductions between general lattices to special classes of lattices. And also, there are some connections between lattice problems. We know that shortest vector problem can be reduced to the closest vector problem, but these reductions typically destroy cyclicity, and seeing if the same can be proved for cyclic lattices is an open question. And well, so far we showed how to build one-way functions, and in principle, and collision-resistant hash functions. In principle, this can be used to build any other many other cryptographic primitives, but using inefficient constructions. Finding efficient direct constructions of other cryptographic primitives based on ideal lattices would be interesting from a practical point of view, and I ran out of time. I could go on forever with problems and problems, but I mean, if you want more problems, just come talk to me and give you more. Harder to prove. For me, it was an exercise, but so it's Mahler's theorem.
Okay. With a mess ask whether you can extend your methods from lattices to indefinite quadratic forms. Because the point is, lattice problems are hard, are even harder than this case log in a certain sense, because you have this worst case, average case reduction. But they only become hard for dimension, for quite high dimensions. They are not part of dimension 100. But problems for indefinite quadratic forms are already NP-hard in dimension 5.
Yes.
And that's really a difference.
Yeah.
And I think that the high-tie worst case, average case reduction can in fact be adjusted from lattices to indefinite quadratic forms.
Oh.
And this in fact would make indefinite quadratic forms quite effective.
Oh, yeah, I was not aware of that, and this is not something that I tried, but that sounds very... So is this something that is addressed anywhere, or is...
Oh, this is an immediate consequence of the NP-hardness result of Ehlmann-Manders, that the quadratic equations in two variables are already NP-hard, and you combine it with the results that you can, that every the natural integer is the sum of the four squares. That's an immediate consequence.
So it seems, at least to what we currently know, that lattices are resistant to quantum attacks. Do you think that these kind of very structured lattices, like the cyclic ones, might fall more easily to quantum attacks?
I think that's an that's a good reason to look at it. So, I mean, we are using lattices for cryptography. It doesn't mean I wouldn't like to see a quantum algorithm for lattices. I mean, people have been trying to find such things. So far, we couldn't. So maybe attempting to find a good quantum algorithms for cyclic lattices, who knows? It might quite well be possible. Lattices seem to have a lot of structure that is potentially useful in the quantum setting. I don't know how to do it, but it's very interesting.
I would like to ask a question concerning the cyclic lattices. I mean, the cyclicity of the lattice seems to be a property of its representation. So if I give you, so this means depends on the basis of the underlying vector space that you use to represent this lattice. If you change the basis, then the lattice does not look cyclic anymore. Do you have an invariant characterization of cyclic lattices?
Okay, so I think that what you're saying is essentially an explanation of why LLL doesn't do any better, right? So if you change the cyclicity, depends on the coordinate system. If you rotate the coordinate system, the cyclicity property is not there anymore. LLL is invariant under is a geometric algorithm. If you rotate the lattice, LLL will perform exactly the same sequence of operations, up to rounding errors, of course. But not every lattice can be written as a cyclic lattice up to a change of coordinates. It's also clear.
It's a symmetry.
I don't know. Okay, so it's a symmetry property. I don't know how to characterize those lattices.
But there are automorphisms that keep the length of the vectors, apparently.
There is enough. Okay.
And it has like a cyclic automorphism group that keeps the length of the vectors.
Yeah, so I know that from a computational
it's basically a module over the ring of cyclotomic integers, the way to characterize it.
This characterizes.
And one thing that makes, but this is a good basis, the bad bases kind of come from the fact that the last group of those rings is huge.